You know what's really, really hard is to see and believe things that we say we see and believe. Do you realize how many times when you use the phrase, it's no big deal, it's probably a big deal to someone? Like, we say things that we kind of give voice to all the time that aren't necessarily what we actually feel. We do this in faith constantly. We'll say something about God that, do we really believe that? Or is it just kind of, you know, it's the right thing to say, so you say it, but maybe it hasn't taken root. Maybe it hasn't changed your life. Maybe you don't live as if that's true. We have all of these little sayings that we go around with, and it's not just about faith, just in life. You know, how are you doing? Oh, I'm just fine. How many times have you said that where you probably not, you know, but it's just, it's what you say. It's what you want it to be, but it's not necessarily always true. We are about to spend the next 6 weeks on one psalm, and it's not even a long psalm. It's a 6-verse psalm. We're going to spend all of Lent on Psalm 23. And for some of you, you're like, ugh, because either you know it well, or because that just doesn't sound like the epitome of excitement to you. But the reason that we're going to do that is that sometimes there are such formative passages in the scripture that when they take root in us in the right way, we begin to move from saying, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not be in want, just the classical translation, to actually believing that God is your shepherd and that you lack nothing. Sometimes the things that we say are very different than the things that deep down in the core bones of our body, the deepest depths that we feel and that we can bank our lives on. And instead we say, well, yeah, that's totally true. We'll get into that a little bit later. But I want you to take a look at the 23rd Psalm. We're going to do some unique things with encouraging you to have this down in, like, etched into your soul by the end of these weeks. And we're using a very readable translation that is intentionally probably not one that many of you have memorized, if you do have one memorized. We're doing that totally on purpose because we don't want any assumptions to be made. We want you to see and experience this story fresh. The Lord is my shepherd is the first passage, the first statement in the 23rd Psalm of David. I have all I need. He lets me rest in green meadows, and he leads me beside peaceful streams. He renews my strength. He guides me along right paths, bringing honor to his name. Even when I walk through the darkest valley, I will not be afraid, for you are close beside me. You notice we just switched tenses. We'll talk about that in a couple weeks. Your rod and your staff protect and comfort me. You prepare a feast for me in the presence of my enemies. You honor me by anointing my head with oil. My cup overflows with blessings. Surely your goodness and unfailing love will pursue me all the days of my life, and I will live in the house of the Lord forever. You realize the Bible wasn't written in English, right? So let's hear this poem for real.
Mizmor le David, Adonai ro'i lo ehsar. Bin ot deshe yarbitzeni, al me menuchot yinahaleni. Nafshi yeshovev, yanheni vema'agele tzedek lema'an shimo. Gam ki elech bege tzalmavet, lo ira ra. כי אתה עמדי, שבתך ומשענתך, המה ינחמוני. תערוך לפני שולחן נגד צורריי, דשנת ושמן ראשי, כוסי רוויה. אך טוב וחסד ירדפוני כל ימי חיי, ושבתי בבית אדוני, לאורך ימים.
I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. The reason that we want to talk about this is that because there is so much depth in a poem like this, written from the perspective of David, who had lived for years and generations on a hillside, watching over sheep. and then becomes, from a very humble beginning, becomes the king of Israel, which is often talked about in terms of shepherding in the scriptures. So today we're going to look mostly at the idea of what it means that David declares, "The Lord is my shepherd. I have all I need." All right? Many of the leaders of the Bible started off as shepherds. Have you thought about that before? Moses was a shepherd. Jacob was a shepherd. The 12 sons of Jacob were shepherds. David was a shepherd. And many of our scriptures that we have, specifically in the Old Testament, they deal with language that talks about God being a shepherd, or at least the leaders of God's people being shepherds. So take a look at some of these. This is in 2 Samuel when David's called, and the Lord said to him, "You will shepherd my people Israel." It was a play on words because David had already been a shepherd for much of his life. "And you will become their ruler." In Numbers, though, it's the same idea right before Joshua was called. "May the Lord, who gives breath to all living things, appoint someone over this community to go out and come before them, one who will lead them out and bring them in, so that the Lord's people will not be like sheep without a shepherd." So there's a risk established early in the scriptures that it's possible for people to be like sheep that need a shepherd. In Ezekiel, he's receiving the words from God, and he's prophesying, which is declaring truths. And he's here's what he's told by God. "Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel," the leaders of Israel. This isn't the people that are actually watching sheep by shepherds, the people who are overseeing Israel. "Say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to you shepherds of Israel who only take care of yourselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock?" So there's this idea, what is a shepherd supposed to do? Well, they're certainly not supposed to only take care of themselves. They've got one job, take care of the flock. Ezekiel later on, just a couple verses later, he's speaking, and God essentially is speaking through Ezekiel and saying, because you leaders have done such a poor job, you know what? I will be the one that steps into this role. "I will search for the lost and bring back the strays. I will bind up the injured and strengthen the weak. But the sleek and the strong I will destroy." He earlier has talked about how they became sleek and strong by ignoring the needs and the causes of the poor and by focusing on themselves and their own advancement to the detriment of many other people. "I will shepherd the flock with justice," which is the same word as mercy. It's interesting to think about why David looks back and decides to declare, "The Lord is my shepherd." What were a shepherd's tasks in day-to-day life regularly? We tend to really romanticize this idea. Shepherding is serious business, and it's one of the few trades, much like sword making, that has not changed for generations and generations, hundreds of years. Shepherding is still done today in much the same, now there's a little more technology that comes into use, but much the same way that it was done hundreds of years ago, specifically in certain places around the earth. In Wales, interestingly, a couple of years ago, there was this article about the Department of Agriculture, sent this article to the city saying, "Hey, we need a shepherd. Are you tired of the crazy life of running to and fro? You can be a shepherd for us in the hillsides." And this guy who had been a shepherd for generations wrote an opinion article, a letter to the editor, saying, "It's great that you're advertising to city slickers. There's no way they've got what it takes to do this job." And so here's the guy that wrote the article, and here's what he said. He says this: "You need to be tough as old boots. Imagine working for weeks on end in the rain and then the snow, the lambs dying of hypothermia, with the difference between life and death being you and your knowledge. Even if you do your best, they will still die, and you will need to keep going. The romance wears off after a few weeks, believe me, and you'll be left standing cold and lonely on a mountain. It's about endurance. Digging in, holding on. You will also need to be emotionally tough, because part of shepherding is that things don't just die, they're killed. Lambs are bred and sold for meat. Nature kills as well. Carrion crows hang over our lambing fields, waiting to steal the eyes of anything sick or dead that cannot resist. You may have to skin dead lambs to use the coat on an orphan lamb to get it adopted. You will need to understand the other shepherds, perhaps when they are bawling at you in the wind from half a mile away, telling you what you're doing wrong on the mountain in Welsh. Shepherding in the mountains isn't an escape from other people. That's an urban escape fantasy. It's actually about working with them in ancient communal ways that they inevitably understand better than you. You will have to listen, do as you're told, and learn fast. Expect a tongue lashing or 10 from your inevitable mistakes. Shepherding is often conservative with a small c. Things are done how they have always been done, often for good reason. Time is the toughest trial for new ideas. You will need a couple or more great sheepdogs. Training a sheepdog takes a couple years, so hopefully you can start a while ago, or you'll have thousands to spend to buy them ready trained. A shepherd without great dogs is just a fool running around a mountain, waving their hands, achieving nothing. You need to have studied the Welsh mountain sheep so that you are not completely clueless when it comes to making key breeding and selling decisions. It takes about 3 generations to acquire the knowledge to be someone in the world of shepherds. I'm a fairly experienced shepherd, but if I went to Snowdonia, that's where this is, it would take me a decade or more to learn how to judge their sheep properly. You'll need the patience of a saint, too, because sheep test you to the limit with a million innovative ways to escape, ail, or die. For all of these reasons, this probably isn't a job for someone unfamiliar with the mountain. It's sheep and it's people. The apprenticeship period for a shepherd is about 40 years. You are just a boy or a lass until you're about 60. It takes that long to really know a mountain, the vagaries of its weather and grazing, to know the different sheep, their marks, shepherds, the bloodlines, and to earn respect of the other shepherds. This isn't just a fellow walking behind a sheep with a dog friend. It requires a body of knowledge and skills that shepherds devote decades to learning. So by all means, apply for this job if you're looking to escape your urban woes. But recognize that doing so without the right experience and skills is a bit like turning up at NASA and telling them that you'd like to be an astronaut. And shame on us when we think that the knowledge of something that seems humble, like shepherding, couldn't possibly compare to something like NASA, right? Like the way our minds think, you know. But what a profound thought. The more you think about this, when then David declares, "The Lord is my shepherd." By the way, the Lord, he is the proper name Yahweh in this case. There's multiple words: Elohim, Creator God. There's the generic term for God, but this is. The God of Abraham. This is Yahweh. Yahweh is a fabulous amalgamation of the 3 verb tenses in Hebrew of to be. Have been, am presently, will be. All combined. Little letters from each of them to create the proper name Yahweh. That's why nobody really knows how to define it. Some say, I am that I am. Some biblical scholars say it's, I will be who I will be. But we look at the Revelation call the one who was and is to come. That's probably the best for it. But it's this name of the God of the whole universe, but the personal name, Yahweh, the God who was in the beginning, is now, and will be forever, is my shepherd. David moves from this immense statement, but he says, I know the personal name, and he's my shepherd. What a statement to be able to make. Interestingly, over the years, after David's life, the idea of what a shepherd is by the time of Jesus had changed drastically. So shepherds were held in fairly high regards in the Old Testament. You look at all of the leaders were once shepherding. But at the time of Jesus, shepherds had moved to kind of the outside of society. They were the outcasts. That was normative. This is why it's so significant that in our birth story of Jesus, that the shepherds are the first ones to receive the news. It's God turning the world upside down. So the angels come and they declare to the shepherds that Jesus has been born this morning. And the shepherds go down and they're the first eyewitnesses. The thing is that shepherds couldn't testify in court at that point because they weren't considered reliable witnesses, just like women, who also receive the first news of the resurrection. God is turning the world upside down. So when Jesus comes, it's so significant that Jesus decides to actually make a statement about himself that harkens back to this psalm in John 10. So in John 10, Jesus declares, after talking about the shepherds, we're talking about this metaphor of sheep for a number of verses, and about how the real shepherds, they don't ever leave their sheep behind. The real shepherds, they know how to enter through the right gate. They don't climb over a fence and try to take over. He's talking about all these other things that we're not going to get into today. But here's what he says. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and they know me, just as my Father knows me, and I know the Father. So think about the life of a shepherd. So I sacrifice my life for the sheep. I have other sheep too that are not in this sheepfold. I must bring them also. They will listen to my voice, and there will be one flock with one shepherd. I love that Jesus identifies himself, number one, as a good shepherd, linking directly with the psalm, but the message of the psalm that says, the Lord is my shepherd. So Jesus does this and says, I am a good shepherd. I am the good shepherd. Uses the the article there. I am the good shepherd. I am the one that David spoke of in fullness. And I'm the type of shepherd that cares so deeply for sheep. So number one, he connects himself to Yahweh. Number two, he talks about his absolute commitment to the sheep. Number three, he identifies himself as the shepherd, which redeems the image and, interestingly, places himself metaphorically along with the outcasts of the day. Excuse me. Isn't that great? He does both of these things at the same time. He identifies himself as Yahweh, and he identifies himself with the outcast all at the same time in the same moment. It's so brilliant what happens and how he does this. I love this. And then he follows it by declaring in verse 16 that he has sheep that are outside the sheep pen too. So he's making space for them as well. I love this guy being my shepherd. Look at what he done. I would follow him anywhere. It's powerful. It's powerful, powerful that David decides to describe Yahweh as a shepherd. But one of the reasons, because David intricately knew the life of shepherds, one of the interesting things about declaring that God is my shepherd, not just a shepherd, is that David is then self-defining himself, self-identifying as a sheep. I just want to be a sheep. Anybody grow up in Bible school singing that song? I pray the Lord my soul to keep. I just want to be a sheep. Bop, 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 bop. Yeah. So the things we do to our children. But the fascinating thing again here is we use this today as what it's used as a put down, right? You sheeple. You can't think for yourselves. Why do people say that? Why is it a societal put down to call someone a sheep? Because, well, you just go wherever you're told. You don't know how to think for yourself. It's pretty accurate. David says, "The Lord is my shepherd." We're told in the scriptures that we have been given the mind of Christ, not of ourselves. So it's true. It's true. To take on the nature of a sheep, sheep are fascinatingly unimpressive. Do you know that if a sheep falls on its back, it dies? It's like worse than a turtle. Check it out. Okay, seriously. Here's a video on how to save a sheep's life if it falls over.
If you see a sheep in this position, it's very easy to save its life. Simply walk quietly and steadily up to it and roll it over. Once it's the right way up again, the sheep will probably run back to the flock. But as you can see, this sheep's still quite wobbly. She was probably on her back for some time and is finding it hard to balance again. If this is the case, it's worth pausing to make sure it doesn't fall over again. When I helped her up, this ewe panicked so much, she nearly toppled over again in a haste to get away from me. This is because she was already in shock.
Oh, man. David says, Lord is my shepherd, so I am the Lord's sheep. I am the Lord's sheep. So sheep are helpless and defenseless. If they fall on their back, they're done for. I love that parallel. Because just think about our lives. How many of us have experienced that in our lives already, where something happens and you feel like life knocks you over in such a way that you are just utterly helpless and hopeless? Where it just happens and you're like, I probably should be able to figure this out, but, you know, here I am. Time for sheep drawings. And you're just like, uh-oh. And so we have this reality of not being terribly, I did that, yeah, he's got a frown on, yeah, okay. Where we're just not terribly impressive. But the other thing about sheep is it's not just that they're helpless physically often, but they make terrible emotional and cognitive decisions. Okay, they're not smart. So they will eat poisonous plants if given the chance. Okay. That one's got strange red stripes on it. Maybe it's strawberry. They don't pick up on the realities of what nature is trying to communicate with them about what's good to eat and what's not. I watched a video that was actually quite traumatic. I decided not to show it. Of a sheep that saw a little patch of grass on this rock hillside and went out to try to get it. And the shepherd's filming it with yelling at it, but filming with a cell phone as well, because he can't, it's way too steep. And we literally watch him take a few bites, take another step, and slide down the cliff and off the cliff. And dies. That's it. That was it for the sheep. And so sheep don't make great decisions if left to their own devices. But here's the third thing about sheep. So they're weak. They easily get themselves in trouble. They don't make great decisions, but they're still incredibly valuable. Wool has changed the course of human history, what they offer. In medieval England, wool was 70% of England's foreign commerce. Wool has been the testing ground for us to develop synthetic fibers now that can help keep people alive in freezing, and wool is still used even though we've developed synthetic fibers. It's a fascinating substance, and so I find it interesting that the dependency of sheep by their nature does not mean that they're not valuable, not even by a little bit. They simply need the right care to flourish and to offer their value to the world. Lent is this excellent time for us to acknowledge before God that we don't always know how to survive on our own, that we have blind spots, that we might get into trouble if we focus too much on our own self-reliance. The reality is that we need constant oversight and constant care and guidance. All right, it's just the reality of learning to identify like David is just to know that we need care and guidance. And here's the thing. For most of us, that type of acknowledgement is almost embarrassing. To admit that we need constant care and guidance. It's seen as a weakness in our world to say that we are dependent. And it always will be, by the way. It will always be a weakness to admit dependency. But one of the things here of the good news that we've been given is it's actually okay to rest in the fact that we are sheep on our back that need constant care and guidance. It's okay to rest in that because the Lord is our shepherd. Because Yahweh is our shepherd, because Jesus is our good shepherd. And Jesus is committed to us like the most steadfast shepherd that has ever lived. Jesus sees us. Jesus knows. I love the thread that comes through in Mark 6. Jesus looks at he's been having a long, hard day, and a crowd follows him. He's trying to get away, but he lands, and he sees a crowd that had been following him, and what does he do? He looks and has compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So Jesus looks and says, they need care and guidance. I can offer that. And Jesus chooses to meet them. Instead of rejecting them, instead of saying, I just spent all day teaching to you, how have you guys not gotten it yet? You sheeple. He doesn't do that. Jesus looks at them and he sees. You need care. You need guidance. You're like sheep walking around a hillside having no idea what to eat and no idea where to go. I can help. I can guide. So he comes and teaches because he knows we need to be led. And then he tells a story in Luke. It's interesting. You can find shepherding analogies in every one of the Gospels in different ways. So John, he talks about being the good shepherd. Mark, he sees him as sheep without a shepherd. This is a motif, okay? Motif means a theme that weaves its way through the whole Gospel. And here in Luke, he actually tells a story right before the prodigal son story, or the lost son's story. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders, and he goes home. He talks about the celebration that happens when people turn back to God. But interestingly, in the story, the shepherd's the one chasing after them. You get that? He says anytime someone turns back to God, but in the story that he tells, that the shepherd is actively involved in that turning back, chasing, pursuing, going after. I love it. The active part is Jesus. The active part of this chasing and going after. Jesus knows we're going to wander off, so he chases after us. So in light of this reality, David looks at Yahweh, and he thinks about the implications of his life as a shepherd, and he declares simply, "The Lord is my shepherd." And then he says the next phrase, "I will lack nothing. I will not be in want. I have all I need. I will not want." There's all these different ways of describing the word that he's saying, but it's all down to the exact same thing. I can fully trust in this life when God is my shepherd. It is so difficult to move toward this sort of abundance in our lives, toward this sort of attitude, but it can happen when we truly learn the heart of God. However, it requires us to separate plenty and lack from a health and wealth gospel. And when most of you hear health and wealth gospel, you do the same thing as I do. You throw up in your mouth a little bit. But here's the thing. We tend to think that practically most of the time. You might not think and name it and claim it. I love God, I'm going to get rich. But inverse, you do think it most of the time. What does it mean to trust that God will provide? We almost always think in terms of the physical. What does it mean that God's my shepherd? Well, okay, that means that I'll definitely get a job right away, I guess that means I'm gonna get healed from this sickness that's ailing me. Sometimes those things happen, and God guides and cares in that way, absolutely. But we're still linking the idea to the good life that is linked to our physical circumstances. This is the most radical part of trusting the absolute abundance of Jesus. And we can't learn this except from someone that we look at and say, how? We can't learn this based on head knowledge. It doesn't work to see God's abundance until you hear the story of Johnny Erickson Tata, who, if you're not familiar with her story, when she was, I believe, a late teenager, she dove into 3 feet of water, and she snapped her spinal column, or her spinal cord, and was paralyzed for the rest of her life. And she has become a prominent Christian leader. She does artwork with her mouth and a paintbrush, and is just a beautiful soul about having a full, beautiful life and seeing the abundance of God in the midst of things that we can't even imagine grasping. And we have to see it lived out by people who so fully believe that the Lord is their shepherd that they can absolutely experience abundance in ways that we say, what? Paul writes to the church in Philippi midway through his struggles in being a missionary, in which he's had been shipwrecked, he's been stoned. Paul got stoned and survived. We'll talk about that a different day. Paul's been through unbelievable things. He's wounded people deeply. He's been beaten and tortured. And you know what he says when he's writing to the Philippian church? He said, they sent him some money. And he says, hey, thanks, I don't need it, but thank you so much for caring. I'll receive that as the fact that you care. But just so that you know, here's what he says, just so you know, I know how to live on almost anything or with everything. I've learned the secret of living in every situation, whether it's with a full stomach or empty, with plenty or little. For I can do everything through Christ who gives me strength. I can live in abundance whether I'm hungry, whether I'm going hungry. What kind of a gospel is this? Whether I'm well-fed, whether things in my life are going great or they're falling apart. The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. The grace of God, the love of God is so securing, is so full that I can rest knowing that I am absolutely loved beyond any situation. It's like in Daniel when Nebuchadnezzar said, I want everybody to kind of bow down to this idol. And Daniel's friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, we're not going to do that. Okay. And he said, okay, I'm going to kill you. All right. And they said, okay. And so they made this furnace really hot. And they threw him in, and they said, oh, king, one second, real quick. We think God might rescue us in this moment, which he does. And it's beautiful, but that's not even close to my favorite part of the story. Because right after that, he says, but if he doesn't, we're never going to worship you. You're not a good shepherd. And so they declare right off the bat, we don't know what's going to happen. There is mystery to life. There is mystery to the way God works. We know God's not our spiritual ATM. You don't just plug in the right code and get what you want. But somehow, when you connect with God's heart, there is such a change in who you are and how you see the world, in how you are able to handle the biggest struggles of your life, that it doesn't matter. That we can move beyond that and be so fully accepted and loved that we can handle almost anything. It's profound and it's beautiful. So compare Paul's statement with the passage, I have enough, right? David says, compare this with the critique that is given in the book of Revelation to the church in Laodicea when John declares it. And John looks and he says to this church, as he's giving a message to seven churches, he says, you say, you folks in Laodicea in the church here, you say I'm rich. I have everything I want. I don't need a thing. That is the same language, by the way, as the 23rd Psalm. You say you lack nothing. And you don't realize that you're wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. You've gone chasing after things outside of the sheep pen because you thought that you could rely on yourselves, but you're not capable of that. You thought that by getting enough stuff, by looking good enough, by feeling good enough on your own, we can survive. But what ends up happening is the emperor has no clothes. You think that you've got enough because you've got, what, riches? But you're miserable. You're poor. You're blind and you're naked. The people on the outskirts of society have it better than you. Because you think you've got it made and your souls are dead and empty. This is the difference between the idea of abundance that David talks about and that Jesus offers and the idea of abundance that comes into our mind most of the time when we talk about this stuff. And we want to do it the right way. With the Jesus way. But let's face it, we're tempted constantly to think about abundance in terms, you know. I mean, goodness gracious, we just talked as a church about like this next season, a month ago or so, and about how we are going to lean into some new things because we're in a season of abundance where God is growing us in generosity and stuff like that. That's great that right now we're being invited into being radically generous, but our abundance goes way beyond all that. Our abundance goes because we have people who have been changed by the Spirit of Christ in this community. And Jesus gives us all we need. We could be penniless. We could be penniless and we would lack nothing. This is hard. This is the difference between saying we trust God and entrusting ourselves to God. We can say we trust God and it can kind of stay out there. But when you entrust yourself to something, you say, I am fully placing myself in the responsibility of God in the way that I look at my needs and wants. It doesn't mean that we don't ever need to go and do things on our own. That's not, hopefully you're hearing this. It's a state of our spirits and our souls and how we walk around. We are owned. We belong to God. In ancient Israel, because shepherds would cross mountains and valleys and fields and they didn't have fences very often, how do people know which sheep belong to who if they would go off and stray? What would happen is the shepherd, this is a little gory, but the shepherd would have to mark their sheep. These days they have tags or they spray their butts a certain color. But back then they would have to take a knife and take a sheep's ear and carve an initial or a shape into the ear of the sheep. And that was the mark that showed that you belong to something. Being marked on the head or the forehead was the way of showing in the scriptures that you belonged to somebody. In the midst of the Old Testament, and there were slavery was still heinous. It looked slightly different than it looked in our country's history. Still heinous, but there was a possibility in the law that if a slave felt like they belonged to their master's household so fully, that they were so fully cared for, that when the time came for their freedom, they could go to their master and say, I believe that my life here, the care that I receive, is better than what my freedom would look like. And so they would become a bond servant, it would be called. They would take their ear and the master would take their ear and put it against the doorway of the house and take an awl and pierce their ear against the doorway. And what that did is it said, it gave them a mark forever. And it said, you are a part, literally, are a part of this household from now on. And the master had took complete responsibility then to care for every need of the servant or the slave. They continued to serve, but they served out of a completely different heart because now they felt like my life here is better than any other option could possibly be. So I want to commit myself to this family. So the mark was a sign of belonging. Some of us on Wednesday received ashes on our forehead as a practice of being marked and belonging to Jesus in humility to begin these 40 days of Lent. That's the story. It's a fabulous, fascinating story. And to me, that's a glimpse of completely trusting in the right person's care, knowing that our needs would be met. Until we grasp the sort of conviction and relationship that David's speaking of, we'll often give words to having enough in Jesus, but our desires and our actions won't always match it. There's a kind of reality that leads us to be like both and Christians, or what I like to call Jesus plus Christians. Okay, so a Jesus plus Christian gives all the language and framework to saying I trust Jesus, plus all the things that I need to do to achieve the good life. Okay, and so it's like, well, Jesus is sufficient. We'll sing it, you know. I have all I need. Jesus is my sufficiency. I lack nothing. But in reality, we're filled with worry all the time about having enough. In reality, we complain constantly about our life situation or how much time and energy our children take from us or the difficulty of our job or whatever we perceive the lack might be. We spend the bulk of our time trying to accumulate enough to feel like we lack nothing and can live well. That's living as a grass is always greener Christian. Saying, God's my shepherd, but shoot, that field over there looks tasty, right? And so I'll go over there. In many cases, that causes real damage to our souls and to others when that attitude takes over. And one of the pastors that I appreciate, he used to say, if the grass is always greener on the other side, water your dang grass. He didn't use that word. God's given us amazing nourishment, but maybe we've been trampling on it. It's still there. The nourishment's there. Maybe we constantly lack because we haven't been sheepish enough to take a step back and let God teach us what we want. Sheep don't know what they want. That's one of the challenges. So part of it is having to invite God. God, help us learn what we want. Trust in God and he will give you the desires of your heart is Psalm 37, verse 4. Trust in God and he will give you the desires of your heart. We often have twisted that to our own little version of the gospel that says if we trust in God, he'll give us what we want. But it's talking about trusting in God means getting the desires of our heart. Do you understand? Trust in God and you will get the desires of your heart because when you trust in God, your desires change and it's being met by trusting in God. You are getting the desires of your heart. It's not an earning what I want out there. It's the fact that by trusting in God, I experience having all I need. And for some of you, that just sounds like baloney. And I get it. So this is the idea behind fasting. Fasting says that I take away something that I want, and then I redirect that desire and energy to God, and I learn what's really worth wanting. I learn what's really worth wanting in that way. I learn a new and deeper truth than I knew before. If life is smooth for a season, hooray. How can I use that season to share goodness with others? If life is difficult for a season, God is my shepherd. What opportunity do I have to trust God and lean on his strength because I will not be shaken from the foundation of eternal love that I've received through Jesus? So either way, I'm absolutely content. That's my prayer. That's my prayer for me. A life without lack is being completely satisfied and sustained no matter what happens. So here's the dirty little secret. I'm not convinced that I actually believe that. I'm not convinced that I have the strength to trust in God's provision if times get really, really tough. I'm not sure that I have all I need in God. Those are hard things. They're easy to say. So what do we do? What do I do? What do you do when you don't feel it? When it seems not true that you lack nothing. What about the times when you look around and all you feel is lack? You just look around and you say, I'm emotionally depleted. I'm spiritually depleted. All I feel is lack right now. I'm stressed. How am I going to get by? Here's my encouragement. Speak it out anyway. Interestingly, there are times in our lives where we cannot see the truth in something until we begin acting as if it were true. We cannot see the truth in something until we begin acting as if it were true. We have to begin declaring it sometimes before it's reality. I can't talk about this without thinking about Stuart Smalley from Saturday Night Live. I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. But without a name it and claim it attitude, there is so much truth there that we have to start declaring what we believe to be true and want to be true sometimes before we experience the truth of it. Dwayne took us through just in a little comment about talking that Lent is parallels the 40 days of Jesus in the desert during the temptations. So Jesus is tempted, and what his response is when he's hungry is, man does not live by bread alone, but on the word of God. Why does he say that? Because he's tempted to believe otherwise at that moment. Because he's hungry, and he's tempted to believe that man lives on bread, and that bread looks great, and I can change this stone into bread. But what he does is he declares something that he wants to believe to be true, and you know what happens right afterwards? The temptation leaves. The tempter leaves until a different time. He speaks something into reality, and what that does is it curbs his desires, and it reminds him of what's true. We got to talk this stuff out, even if we don't always believe it. That matters. We have to live ourselves into new ways of thinking and new ways of understanding. So I don't particularly care if you feel like you lack nothing under Jesus or not. What I care about is encouraging you to begin speaking it and acting like it during these 6 weeks in order to open yourselves to the possibility of its truth. I think you'll find it to be supernaturally true and profoundly true. Our heart and hope is that we can start to grasp that this life of all I need is one that is completely satisfied and completely sustained, not because of what happens in our lives, but in spite of what happens, no matter what happens in our lives. So, I want to practice or encourage you to practice in growing to trust God as a shepherd. And so what we're going to do is we are going to give you each one of these. Can a couple of you come and hand them out? I didn't want to say at the back because half of you will forget. I want every single one of you to take one of these little cards. It fits in your wallet. It fits on your dashboard. It fits on your fridge. Some place that you're going to see it and have it with you every single day. I want these to be tattered and worn by the end. And it's simply the prayer, the poem, I mean, of Psalm 23. And what we want you to do is we want you to read it, not in your head, but out loud every single day for the next 40 days. We want you to read it out loud every day. Lent is a great time for slow repetition, to embrace the annoyance and the beauty of slow repetition, because slow repetition is annoying and it's beautiful. It's annoying to admit the ongoing weakness and need of the sheep and the frustration at how our spiritual journey tends to cycle over and over and over again, things we think we ought to be better by now. And there's so much beauty in the constancy of the Good Shepherd and the ever-ready availability of grace. So we start over again and again and again every year, and we tell the stories, and we walk with Jesus through Lent, and we celebrate the hope of Easter again and again and again because we need to, because again and again and again is the truth of our reality. Again and again, we stray like sheep. Again and again, Jesus reaches out, pulls us back, and continues to offer grace and transforms our hearts. So every single day I want you to read that. I want to encourage you to. I want it to get into your bones. And we're going to talk about the different facets of trust over the next few weeks. Let's pray. Jesus, thank you for the hard lessons of trust, the things that sound easy to recite. Help us in our moments of really trying to grasp the beauty of what you are and how you love us. Transform us in such a huge way, Lord, that we can't help but spill out a life of shalom and peace to the people that we meet, that they would see that there's something different about us because we have learned the secret to be content in every and every situation, because we can do all things and have all strength through you. Meet us where we are right now at the beginning of this season. Let us be honest with ourselves, Lord, as we look to the day of your resurrection. but give us the grace to sit and to wait and to walk along with you in the 40 days in the desert. Thanks for your gift of constancy, Lord. Amen.